We'll pass this around. As usual, we have kind of lines that have like warped lines. So make sure it gets to the warps and the woofs. And this very first one is a really good one to sign up for. If you've never done it, it's the most exciting thing that ever happened. It's entitled Help Set Up the Church, 2:30 p.m. on Sunday. Eric would love you forever if you would put your name and your phone number on there and actually show up at 2:30 on Sunday. That would be really good. So if you can sign up, that would be good. Happy New Year. I want to read Micah 6, 1 through 9. It's what I'm going to be speaking out of this evening. And I'm just going to read the whole passage and then talk a little bit out of it. It says, listen to what the Lord says. Stand up, plead your case before the mountains. Let the hills hear what you have to say. Hear, O mountains, the Lord's accusation. Listen, you everlasting foundations of the earth, for the Lord has a case against his people. He is lodging a charge against Israel. My people, what have I done to you? How have I burdened you? Answer me. I brought you out of Egypt and redeemed you from the land of slavery. I sent Moses to lead you, also Aaron and Miriam. My people, remember what Balak, king of Moab, counseled and what Balaam, son of Beor, answered. Remember your journey from Shittim to Gilgal, that you may know the righteous acts of the Lord. With what shall I come before the Lord and bow down before the exalted God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000 rivers of oil? Shall I offer my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has showed you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? To act justly, and to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. Christmas is past. New Year's started. When you look back at that whole Christmas thing, Christmas bothers me. And what bothers me is the whole present thing, Christmas presents. I wonder if some of you gave or got presents from somebody and you didn't give them anything back. Like they didn't cross your mind. But they actually went out and bought a present for you. Happened to Kathy, some coworker that she trained for just a brief amount of time, really bought her a very nice gift, and Kathy hadn't bought anything. And then you kind of have that struggle, you know, like, okay, should I run out and buy something for him and then wrap it up quick and like pretend I had him in mind all the time, or should I just let it go and just enjoy receiving the gift, or, you know, and then, or you give like a really inexpensive, you know, Hickory Farms meat and cheese thing to somebody who actually thought about you for a long period of time and came up with this really amazing, expensive, extravagant gift that was like custom designed for you, and then you gave them Hickory Farms and you just, I wonder if anybody besides me bought gifts for people simply because they knew they would get a gift for you. You know, you just know they're going to buy me a gift, so I got to buy them a gift and make sure it stays even. You know, that kind of. And then this other thing that, you know, you buy a gift that's not as appropriate or as meaningful as the gift that you've bought before. You know, like a long time ago, I wrote a song for Kathy based on Proverbs 31, and I wrote out the lyrics in calligraphy on parchment, and I got the band at the church to like play the song, and then I sang it, made a tape. You know, it's kind of hard to top that gift, you know? Like, this year I gave her shoes, and it's just not quite the same, you know? Running shoes, and or, you know, it doesn't quite cut it. It's like, but I just don't know how to top that gift. Like, I don't know how to make it better. I don't know what to do to make it a better gift. And then, you know, you give a gift, like you actually put some time into giving somebody a gift, and they open it and you kind of see the disappointment. Oh, that. And you were like so hoping that they would really like it. Anybody besides me have any of those experiences?
No.
Oh, okay. Just never have had? Yeah. Okay. Liars. How does it make you feel when any one of those things happens, or you know, like what goes on inside you as those kinds of things happen?
Yeah, I have to use for this.
Guilt.
Sadness.
Fear. Shame. Embarrassment. So Christmas, yeah, anger. Christmas kind of stresses us out, you know, because that whole gift thing, it just stresses us out. And here's what I was thinking of, why would that be? Why does that part of it stress me out? And I think our problem with Christmas is the transactional nature of our relationships. Relationships are transactions. I give you something, you give me something. In relationships, we get what we want. We trade up, we trade down, you know. We make sure, like, you know, I bought lots of presents for Kathy because, you know, in the end, she's gonna do nice things for me. You know, she likes me. She's been hanging around for 31 years. So I wanna, like, take care of her, but I get something out of the deal. Right? I mean, it's not just it's a bargaining. It's a bargain deal. And I think our problem with God is the same problem that Israel has here. We kind of want to be in control, and we want to have kind of the leadership position. We want to be able to give back to God. You know, we want to kind of make a transaction relationship going with God. We want, and our problem with all these transactional relationships that we want to win, right? We want to win, whatever that means. In some cases, we want to be able to say, well, I outgave them, right? I did more for them than they did for me. We want to win in the relationship. And I think that's our problem with God. We want to win in the relationship. We have this transactional relationship with God, and we want to win. And we make bargains with God. Anybody besides me ever do that? Make bargains with God? God, if you do this for me, I will, and then whatever the deal is, right? You're making a bargain. And have you ever had God like actually give you what you asked for, so then you have to keep your end of the bargain, and then you kind of get forgetful, and, well, okay, I made that deal, but, you know, you kind of go back on it? How about, God, I know I've got this sin, but if you just overlook it, because, you know, it's not as bad as other people's sin, right? I mean, there are people who do really bad things, and sure, I gossip a little and I get a little angry, but, you know, those aren't like really bad sins. Transactions. Deals. Bargains. I'd like freedom from the effects of the actions I've taken. God, if you just do that for me, get me out of this mess one time, just one more time. Well, one more time. One more time, if you just get me out of this, then I'll. So God comes, and he comes as a relational God. but without the deal, without the transactions, without the if-then. God comes and says, I love you, and it's not with condition. I'm afraid the vast majority of our relationships are conditional relationships. If you do this, I'll do this. As long as you, I'll. And if that bargain gets broken, if that deal gets broken, if we win or lose in the transaction, we get upset, we get happy, we win, we lose. So God has a case against Israel. And his question is, how have I burdened you? In other words, what obligations have I made on you? What pain have I caused you? What thing have I done that's hurt you? And then he gives some examples of what he's offered, because God is an offering God, and he just simply gives and gives and gives and gives. And so his case against Israel is sort of along the lines of, well, they don't remember. They don't remember what he's done. They don't recognize what God has done, and they don't respond to his love. That's his case against them. As a matter of fact, his real case against them, as we've been talking, and as you look at the other passages of Micah, is that they run off to other gods, they take on idols, they sell themselves to others, and they give away what he's given them. God gives freedom from slavery. That's the one thing that he talks so clearly about here. I redeemed you. I took you out of slavery. I took you out of Egypt. Egypt is always the picture of slavery. I took you out of there, and I redeemed you, which is a very simple thing. I purchased you. I own you. You're mine. You don't have a choice. I bought you. So if you want to make this a transactional relationship, you are a wholly owned, you know, subsidiary, whatever it is. You've been bought, lock, stock, and barrel. You don't have anything. And then God has Micah remind them of the king of Moab and that whole story of what happened with Balak, the king of Moab. Balak looks out, he's the king of this huge empire, and he sees all the Israelites out there, and he sees how God blesses them, and he is absolutely terrified. And so he doesn't know what to do, so he calls on Balaam, who is a prophet, who's a little bit of a slimy prophet. He's not one of these really upstanding, great prophets. Balaam, and he offers Balaam, the prophet, money, power, prestige, stuff, a transaction, if Balaam will curse Israel, if he'll just curse them. And so Balaam is tempted, and then Balaam says, well, I can't actually do that because I have to say whatever God tells me to say. But in the end, he tries to go to Balak and tries to do this to get the goods, right? Transaction, it's about getting stuff. And he goes his way, and his donkey sees the angel of God standing in the road, waving the sword and about to destroy him. So the donkey like crushes his foot against the wall and, you know, starts talking to him. And it's just, you know, it's a really strange story. And but he doesn't go. And then finally, Balaam ends up going to Balak. And then every time he opens his mouth to curse Israel, hoping to curse Israel, what comes out is a blessing. And so the king of Moab even becomes more terrified. And in the end, there's this huge battle, and Moab is on the run, and and Balak tries to, the king tries to, he actually sacrifices his son to try to overcome Israel. God is saying, look how I took care of you. Look how I provided for you. Look what I've done for you. Remember. Despite Balaam's effort to sell them out, God protects them and he defends them. And their response to all that, and the reason he mentions the city, the town of Shittim, is that that's where Israel, in response to this, takes these Moabite women into, these men go get Moabite women, they marry them, they take their gods, and they begin to worship Baal, they begin to worship the gods of Moab. Instead of this amazing God who's done all this stuff for them, this, you know, if it were a transaction, God's way ahead in the deal. God says that he also offers them leaders. He offers them three leaders that are mentioned here. One is Moses, one is Aaron, and one is Miriam. God offers them Moses. Moses is the leader who brings them the law. He brings them rules. He brings them a judge. Moses stands and listens to all the cases and decides who's right, who's wrong, what's good, what's bad. Moses listens to them and offers them structure and rules and a beautiful way to live. I always get a kick out of the Ten Commandments because the Ten Commandments really have a bad rep, you know? They're just like, they get kicked out of courtrooms and, you know, people get all excited about them. And normally, if I ask, probably even here tonight, nobody can even recite them. But we get all excited about the Ten Commandments. And yet the Ten Commandments are really cool because if you actually all lived by the Ten Commandments, it would be a pretty cool world. Like there'd be no stealing. There'd be no murder. There'd be no adultery. There would be honoring of parents and respect for them. There would be everybody keeping a special day for with God. There'd just be all kinds of cool things that would happen if we actually did that. But of course we don't. And we kind of want other people to do those things, but we want to play fast and loose. And so he offers them Moses, who gives them this beautiful structure. He offers them Aaron, who stands between them and God as a priest. Aaron offers sacrifices on their behalf. He listens to God. He communicates with God. He communicates with them. He does acts of mercy and kindness and grace towards them. And then he offers them Miriam, who sings the songs of victory. She's the great poet and writer of music, and she leads by singing the songs of God's great victories and all the beautiful, wonderful things that God's done. And God also reminds them about Gilgal. Gilgal is the place where they actually crossed the Jordan River, where Israel crossed the Jordan River. But they didn't just cross the Jordan River. The water parted and they, you know, it dried up in front of them, and as they all marched through, and there's this wall of water on the side and another wall of water, and they marched through unharmed, and it's an amazing story. And when they got to the other side, what God asked them to do was to take stones and raise them up, make a monument, and then every time they walk by that monument, and their kid says, Dad, what's a pile of rocks? Or Mom, what's going on with those rocks over there? They're supposed to tell, hey, it's a memorial. It's a thing. We need to just think about the beautiful thing that God did. He gave us a way into this promised land. He's brought us, he's given us safe passage. He's helped us, he's walked with us, he's cared for us, he's provided for us. Gilgal is that place. It's that memorial place. And so this road from Shittim, selling yourself to foreign gods and living with idols, to Gilgal is an amazing journey, and it's sort of a reverse journey because, you know, the thing at Shittim happens after they've crossed. And so it's kind of this sliding back into a really bad relationship with God. And of course, here's where Israel's transactions with God come up. They think, well, if I, they're kind of thinking like, what do we have to do to get back on God's good side? Anybody make those bargains with God? What do I have to do to get back on God's good side? What do I have to do to get back in His favor? And so they say, well, you know, they're thinking, well, 1,000 rams, 10,000 rivers of oil. You know, if I offer my firstborn, if I offer my children, if I sacrifice all this stuff, maybe God would be pleased, and I can win in the relationship. So here's my question: what are some of our transactional relationships with God? What do they look like? What are some of our transactions with God? What do we think if we do what? What do we get? Talk to me about transactions that you've made with God, if you're willing. Kind of a confessional time. I'll start. One of my transactions with God is, God, if you take care of all my physical, financial needs, I'll serve you in ministry. I'll become a pastor. Transaction. A deal with God. Anybody make a deal like that in their life? Keith? Yes, sir.
I'll continue to have faith in you.
I'll continue to have faith if you show me a big sign. God loves me more.
Let me make it the opposite. If you don't give me this, then I won't do what you want me to do. Those are the things that I think are important or really, really want. Then I won't do whatever it is you're asking me.
Don't give me what I want, then I'm not obligated. Other transactions we make with God? Interesting how we make those deals. And interesting how, how does it work out for you? like I think back on these 8 years, you know, God really has provided for me, and He's taken care of my needs financially in every other way. But I don't think it was because I was faithful in keeping my end of the bargain. And the problem with this transactional relationship is it really strikes at the heart of our problem with God anyway, right? Like, if you look at the whole beginning of, you know, Adam and Eve and the temptation that they succumb to is, you know, if you eat of this fruit, you will be like God, knowing the difference between good and evil. So the deal was, we kind of wanted to get into that equality relationship with God at the very beginning. And I think that's kind of how I still am, right? I want to be equal with God. I want to be in the gift-giving mode. I want to outgive God. Now, I'm not stupid. I recognize that that's not going to happen. He's got like resources I don't have, but I still want that transaction to be such that I like kind of win in the relationship, like that somehow I can get ahead of God. And then when it doesn't work out, we make these sacrifices. You know, we think of the 1,000 rams and the 10,000 rivers of oil. So what sacrifices do you make thinking that if you do that, you'll win God's favor?
I think, like, I don't know if I think it's a more physical transaction, but I think of that as like an emotional transaction. So, like, I think I want to win emotionally, because when I think about relationships, it's hard for me to actually like my wife if I don't feel good about her. I have to actually, that would mean I'd have to choose to do something I don't like. And so, it's sort of with God. If God will make me feel good about him, then I'll serve him. And so, when that's not happening, then I'll come up with a list of things I need to do to get me to feel good about God.
Right. Sacrifices that I have to make. Like, I really wanted to be in business and I really wanted to be rich in business, but, you know, okay, I'll sacrifice and I'll become a pastor, but you owe me now, right? Now we've got a deal, because after all, I've sacrificed. I have a pastor friend who was just giving me a litany of all the things that he had done for God, and now God owes him. And, you know, I kind of laughed, like, because it's easy to see it in somebody else, right? It's easy to see it in my friend. It's really hard for me to see it in me, like, to see how transactional I am with God, like, how, what sacrifices I think I've made and what I think now he owes me. He owes me. I did this for him. He owes me. I have sacrificed this. So it's interesting, because what happens then is as this passage goes along and we kind of look through this whole deal that Micah's talking about, we go, well, you know, will the Lord be pleased? I don't know if any of you are like, if I just give him enough that he'll be pleased. But, you know, like, I don't want to make him overjoyed, right? You know, like, I just want to do just enough, not too much, because again, when it becomes a transactional relationship, it becomes that relationship where I want what I want, but I don't want to have to give up too much. So then it says, what does God require of you? So we go, hey, see, it is a transactional relationship. God requires something of us. So obviously it's a transaction. As God's saying to us, you know, if I give you this, then you owe me this. So what does God require? And it's interesting that the first two things that he mentions are two things that are actually toward each other. They're not towards him. The first one is to do justly. Okay, so we're to do justly. But justice has to do with our dealings with each other. And so this isn't like God gets the benefit of our doing justly. People get the benefit of our doing justly. Justice requires doing what is in the best interest of others, doing what is absolutely right, doing what is fair. It's really impossible to separate justice from righteousness. Matter of fact, every time normally that you see those words, you see those put together, and that's because justice, doing what's just, always has that element of rightness to it. Righteousness is the word, but it's about doing right. So we're to do rightness, we're to do fairness, we're to do that for each other. Now, justice, as it's used here, means, as I said, looking out for the interests of others and making things fair. That goes against and strikes at the very heart of a transactional relationship. Because in a transactional relationship, I can win. So when I go to the store and the guy gives me, you know, an extra $20 in change. I can keep it because I won in the transaction, right? He messed up, but it's a big company and they can afford it and it's no big deal. But if I'm in the mode of doing justly, then I have to take the $20 that he gave me in excess change and I have to go back to him and say, here, you gave me too much change, and I have to make it right, make it fair, and I lose in the transaction because I'm out $20, right? It's and have you noticed you always get an incredulous face when you do that sort of thing? You brought that back? You know, are you nuts? You know, I had I put a bunch of bottled water or something on the bottom of a shopping cart once, and when I forgot to tell the person who checked me out, and so when I bring it out to the car, load it all up and get home. Then I realized I never paid for that, so I went back to pay for it. And you know, I talked to the little person who referred me to the manager, and the manager came up and said, "Oh, you know, that's horrible," you know, and then went and fired the employee. Oh. So it's just like, kill me, you know, like, you know, this isn't what I wanted. I wanted to. And he said, "No, this is the last straw. She's done this before, isn't it? You know, it's over for her." And it's like, and then he wouldn't let me pay for it. You know, he. Yeah, exactly. And he wouldn't let me pay for it because she's trained to look under the cart. She's supposed to look under the cart, or, you know, blah, blah, blah. So it was just this awful thing, right? Because it's not right. It's just that the whole transaction went wrong, right? It's just stupid. I should have, like, caught it at the time. So now, whenever I walk up, push a cart, I say, see, I got stuff down here, you know, and you know, make sure you take care of it. Because why? Because I lost, you know, like, there was just loss in that whole transaction. It was just wrong. Transactional relationships, we would like to win or lose if that gets us what we want. But in a fair, doing justly requires doing what's fair, what's right, what's good for everyone concerned. I had a gentleman who's a very wealthy man who I knew, and I asked him once, "How did you become wealthy?" He said, "I've walked away from every deal that wasn't fair for everyone involved." Wow. He said, "I didn't get rich fast, but I've gotten rich." Walk away from every deal that doesn't benefit everyone. Do justly. It says do justly, by the way, which requires movement, right? Which requires action. I mean, it's an action thing. You can't just sit at home watching TV doing justly. You have to search out unfairness. You have to search out that which is not just, which is not right, and make it right. It's an action thing. You have to stand up for people who can't stand up for themselves. You have to look out for people who can't look out for themselves. You need to honor those in authority, and you need to use your strength and your power to make things right. Do justly. But that is all for the benefit of each other. If we all lived like that, it would be a pretty nice world. Love mercy. That's the second thing that God requires of us, is to love mercy. It's an interesting word, because Eric was talking about the kindness thing, and I appreciate the kindness, because it's that same word for mercy that's here. And if you actually look in at the base, at the root of what that word mercy means, it means bowing the neck toward. Bowing the neck toward. Bowing the neck toward. Now, tall people get this, short people, I don't know, but when you're tall, you have to kind of bow down and listen to people, because they tend to talk at like this level down here. And so if you actually want to join the conversation, you have to get down where they're at, so you can hear it. So you know, people think I'm humble when in fact I'm just trying to figure out what's going on. So that bowing the neck thing is kind of, you know, it's easier for tall people than short people. But what really happens in a bowing of the neck is that suddenly you're engaging the person. Right? You're seeing them. When I bow my neck toward, right? I mean, it's a whole thing. When I bow my neck toward, now we're engaged, right? I see you're, or I'm not engaged. I'm married to her, but we're like, I see his face. I know him now, right? I mean, there's some things I know. I see his eyes. I see his face. I see whether he's smiling or wishing I would just go away, or. Like there's things that I can see, there's things that I notice, I can read expressions, I can see anger or hatred or love or caring or gentleness, or when I incline my neck toward, when I bow my neck toward, I'm engaged. I'm hearing, I'm seeing, I'm using all my senses to engage. So mercy is about engaging, bowing our neck toward. But it's also got, so, obviously, by the way, it's the opposite of being stiff-necked, proud, right? The scripture always uses stiff-necked, right? Right? Stiff-necked, proud, right? Not engaging, not being in relationship, not being in a community. I'm on my own. But when I bow my neck toward, I'm engaged. I'm listening. And so it's about the leveling of relationship. Mercy is about the leveling of relationship, which means those who have give to those who do not have. Leveling. It's sort of God's version of communism, you know? It's a leveling of the playing field. It's a leveling of relationship. Mercy is about kindness and generosity. Offering what we have to those who do not have, receiving with grace gifts that God's people give us. So inclining, turning our neck, bowing our neck toward, allows us to become one with each other. To have true community. By the way, the call is not to practice mercy. The call is to love mercy. I think there's a huge difference. I've noticed something really weird about the generosity of people. I worked at Teen Challenge for 3.5 years, so I spent, I think, 4 Christmases there, actually. And every Christmas, they get like 857,000 turkeys donated, right? People get an extra turkey from work and they donate it to Teen Challenge. And you know what? Teen Challenge guys like fresh meat, but you can only eat so much turkey, you know? And come June or July, you know what? When you really die for a turkey, nobody shows up with a turkey, right? There's no meat at all. So they're eating, you know, macaroni and cheese and lettuce and, you know, lettuce sandwiches. And it's just because all of a sudden, well, right, because we're not practicing mercy all the time. We're practicing mercy when we think about it. And you know what? Everybody's generous at Christmas. Because, you know, it's transactional, right? Got a bunch of stuff. Oh, I better go give some stuff away, right? So I'll go give some stuff away because I got a bunch of stuff. But we don't think about that in February or April or June or July. Because we haven't gotten a bunch of stuff then, unless it's our birthday. And then maybe we think about it again, right? Because we make it a transaction. We make mercy a transaction. And so we only practice it occasionally. Wonder what it would be like if we practiced mercy. We've been talking about that a little bit as leaders. How do we do that? Like when some of you are sick, you know, we should be bringing you soup. We should be bringing you a meal. But, you know, we have all these issues about doing that, right? Because we're like, you know, some of you can't eat certain things, and we don't know what that means, and then like maybe you don't like that kind of soup, and you know, there's all these weird like things that we put around that we start getting nervous about, and then you know, like I'm not that good of a cook, and then well, they're a really good cook, but they're sick, and do I bring them good soup or bad soup, or you know, like we just get all confused. Why? Because we right away want to turn it into a transaction. We want to give, but it doesn't become just a generous act. Now, I remember we were poor as all get out when I was a kid, and so after my dad died, people would come and they would bring really good food that was just awful for us. Like, you know, we just couldn't eat it, or because of some problem that we had, we couldn't eat that particular food. But you know what? It wasn't about the food. It was about the generous nature of people who came and offered and gave stuff generously, kindly. And I think, man, if there's any longing that I have for this new year, it's that our community become that to each other. Now, I've seen examples of that and beautiful examples of that, but I want it to just become an everyday thing. I want us to love mercy. Loving mercy is taking pleasure in bending our necks toward, which is like everyday event, that we're always thinking about each other and thinking about those who are needy in our community and those who are hurting. Bending the neck toward assumes listening, looking, it assumes equality, it assumes humility, smallness, making ourselves less. Loving mercy, so that mercy becomes just this passion. Who does that benefit? It doesn't benefit God. It benefits us, our community, the people around us, our neighbors, our friends, our people who are hurting. That's who it benefits. That's the beauty of these first two things. They sound transactional when you first hear them, but they're not transactional with God. They're God's invitation for us to do what He calls us to do. The last thing that He calls us into is to walk humbly with God. Humility, when it comes in our relationship with God, humility is simply recognizing our place. Recognizing who we are in relationship with God. We are not in an equal relationship. And we can't win if we turn it into a transactional relationship, much as we try. Walking humbly means we recognize our place before God. And then we recognize these, and to do that, we recognize these things about Him, that He is bending His neck toward us, right? He is merciful to His people. He engages us. In Christ, in Jesus, He engaged us completely. He became one of us, one like us. He listens to us. He watches us. He cares about us. He pursues us. And He does justice for us. When He sends Jesus, Jesus pays for what I can't pay. He makes me right before God, which is sort of an amazing thing. That if you ask God today, so what does Rod owe you? God looks in a book and says, nothing. It's all been taken care of.